Hello, and welcome to the special bonus episode of A Cast of Kings for Season 3, Episode 2 of House of the Dragon, Queen's Landing. I, as per usual, am one of your hosts, Jesse Earle, and I am here with Kim Renfro, and we're going to talk about comparisons between the show and the book Fire and Blood. Now, just to let everyone know how this is going to work, we are going to do a section first of this bonus episode with no future spoilers from the book. So if you have not read the book, but do want to know a little bit about the comparison between the adaptation choices, we will have that for you. And then we're going to do a quick little section at the end of this bonus video where we will openly discuss stuff that is coming up in the book and what we think may be happening in the show as it relates to it. So I'll give a fair warning when we get to that point, so don't worry about that. And then the last thing just to say in terms of the dynamic, I know with the original setup of the show, David Chen, our original co-host, who we both really love, Kim and I both really love, he had never read the book. And Kim was obviously the super expert who knows everything because she's freaking awesome. But I have also read the book, but I have tried to intentionally, not out of laziness, I swear, but I have tried to intentionally not reread the book in a while. I think the last time I fully read the book was around season one of the show. I reread bits and pieces for season two, and I've not looked at it all since then, intentionally so that when we have this dynamic, I can hopefully be like, what was that? What's going on? Kim, please help. So that's hopefully going to be the dynamic a little bit. But if I do remember something, it's because I have indeed read the book. So it's a little bit of a twist on the dynamic for all of you. But let us jump into it with Kim's lovely summaries. And again, I want to shout out to Kim. Thank you for doing these summaries. You are amazing for doing all this. It's really awesome.
I do my best. So
you do, and your best is freaking awesome. We love it. So, all right, getting into our first thing here, most relevant from these first two episodes of House of the Dragon of this season is the way Prince Jace's involvement with the Civil War was changed from the book account. And then, of course, basically everything to do with Alicent Hightower. But let's start with Jace. In the fictional historical account given in Fire and Blood, which again, for listeners, if you don't remember, Fire and Blood is basically a history textbook taken from like in-universe accounts. Mm-hmm. Jace is driving the decisions during this pivotal time, not Rhaenyra. He's the one who initiates the Red Sewing after Rhaenys dies at Rook's Rest, leading to Hugh and Ulf claiming dragons. It's also his idea to send his youngest brothers, Aegon and Viserys, across the Narrow Sea with Rhaena and to name Lord Corlys the Hand of the Queen. Excuse me, Hand of the Queen. I almost said Hand of the King.
I know.
Being sexist.
That darn patriarchy is in your mind.
Depatriarchify the... I'm going to stop that word.
Matriarchify.
Matriarchifier. Yeah, we'll make matriarchy a verb. Let's do it. The book implies that it was Jace and Corlys together who decided to start an attack on King's Landing with the blockade. That is actually super interesting. I actually completely forgot this from the book with Jace.
Yeah, that like the book in this section, the history is kind of ascribe Rhaenyra and both Rhaenyra and Helaena in this time to be like abed with grief. Oh, like they were going mad, like,
and women, so you know how women be, you know,
just these ladies. And so, yeah, I didn't get into the Helaena of it all in this section, but yeah, it reminds me, like, there's parallels, I think, between how they're kind of both, the show is giving Helaena a much more robust emotional storyline and is making her a much more present character in the dynamics of all of this. And then, yeah, Rhaenyra gets a lot of this leadership back, which I think is important. Like, I think that it adds to the audience's connection with her. I think it adds to like the emotional richness of all of these choices that are being made and the tension between Rhaenyra having an idea for something. And if you remember, like back in season two, I think we touched on this a little bit in our main pod for episode one, but like Jace was in fact opposed to the Red Sewing. And so again, that makes the fact that Rhaenyra has these other dragon riders, like, it makes it so that Rhaenyra in the show surely has more complicated feelings about the fact that she's the one who initiated this. She's the one who thought Corlys should be her hand and that this blockade was like a good idea. And then of course the Alicent scheming of it all, like this undercurrent of Rhaenyra has a plan and Jace is opposed to it and in fact goes out and decides on his own that he's going to lead dragons into the Battle of the Gullet, just completely turns the tensions up on their head. And so I really actually like that Rhaenyra is the one who gets a bit more agency here, and Jace is left having to be frustrated with not being in control of everything.
What I like about it, I like it on a few levels, because one, it does give Rhaenyra more agency, sets her up more as the lead of the show, and certainly as we're talking about women and women in charge, which is kind of a main theme of the show, even more so than is in the book, at least so directly. I like that as just a perspective shift and a choice for the characters. Mm-hmm. But also, there is something like a meta commentary thing, because it was a historical text that we're reading in Fire and Blood, and all of the things that we're getting in Fire and Blood are accounts from people who were there at the time. Mm-hmm. It does sort of have this like meta reading on it of, oh, maybe in part, a lot of the people around Rhaenyra were ascribing it to the boy. It's like, Rhaenyra clearly wasn't the one making the decisions. Hysterical woman.
Very true.
The man did it. And that happens throughout actual history of, like, there are many times where women are the drivers of history or are big contributor to history, but then it all sort of gets ascribed to the famous, you know, great man involved. Yeah. And I think that that's an interesting sort of unsaid but present possible meta commentary there.
Totally. I think that's a great point. And like in the history, it sets up Jace's death as much more of like the tragic prince who like was beloved and only had good ideas, fell in battle. And instead, you know, the show kind of makes it, I think that there's no clear blame for Jace's death, mm-hmm. aside from obviously whoever was shooting massive grappling hooks off the side of boats.
I think whoever shot arrows into his back is probably at least a little bit directly blamed.
Yeah. I'm going to lay the blame at their feet and the people who were like cheering it on from the boat. I was like, excuse me, guys, let's not. I think that that's exactly true. And right, we get again a much more nuanced and complex picture of this prince and what was going on in the final moments of his life. And then of course, like the part that no one would technically know behind closed doors, or in this history, it's interesting because we've touched upon this in the past too, that one of the sources for the histories happening, the histories being told in Fire and Blood, is this character of Mushroom, who's like
best character in the book.
Yeah, like effectively, you know, kind of like a court jester type character who claims to be very close with Rhaenyra at this point and like in all of these conversations and stuff. But Mushroom doesn't exist in the show at all. And so instead, there really is no reason to believe that the history books would have seen that exchange between Jace and Sir Laurent and Rhaenyra that locks her in her room. Like, she's just not there at the battle, because again, in Fire and Blood, she's just not a very active participant in what's going on at this exact moment. And so the show's handing us basically a much more devastating reason why Rhaenyra wasn't there and why Jace was ultimately the greatest loss of that battle, along with everybody else.
Well, jumping on into our comparison here, speaking of Corlys, the sea snake, as many people know him, the history claims that he and Jace together asked Rhaenyra to give Adam and Alan, who are meant to be young teenagers, by the way, in the book, the Valyrian last name and end their bastardization. The show shifted this to a much more meaningful moment by having Corlys offer his name to his sons after the Battle of the Gullet. And actually, also worth saying, I might be misremembering this, but tell me if I'm wrong. I don't believe the sea snake was actually technically at the Battle of the Gullet in the books.
I think you're right. Yes. Yeah. So, him having this like central role and a lot of, again, like the beat by beat who we're following in the battle was all around Corlys and Lohar. Yes, that was invented for the show as well, which I think was really effective.
Yes.
Yeah.
I think it makes it much more directly personal. Like, because Lohar's whole, like, I want to take down the sea snake, it's vaguely there in the book, but it's not like the sacking of Corlys's home, I think, is there, but mm-hmm. it's less directly personal as the show made it, which is much more dramatic, I think. So
yeah, and it really does kind of continue to maybe not entirely close the loop on this, but like add to this this thread that they've been putting into the tapestry of the story ever since season one. Like, I remember back in season one, some people who hadn't read the books were maybe like a little baffled by the constant return to the Triarchy and like the conversation about all of this and stuff. But like, even back then I was thinking to myself, like, well, the Triarchy keeps coming back as like this pivotal player, players in the story. And so, yeah, I thought that that was also like a pretty successful way that they were able to thread these connections.
So the next piece that we should probably talk about is the difference in how Rhaenyra responded to Jace's death, which is what we got at the beginning of this episode. But Kim, what was the difference here between the book Rhaenyra and show Rhaenyra?
Book Rhaenyra is, again, just like super simplified in Fire and Blood in this section. We don't get a ton of witness accounts to her interior mind. Really, the only thing that it says, and I'll just read this quote here. So, quote, broken by the loss of one son, Rhaenyra seemed to find new strength after the loss of a second. Jace's death hardened her, burning away her fears, leaving only her anger and her hatred. Still possessed of more dragons than her half-brother, her grace now resolved to use them, no matter the cost. She would rain down fire and death upon Aegon and all those who supported him, and either tear him from the Iron Throne or die in the attempt.
Metal. Very metal.
Hell yeah. I think I just did love because I do that to my baby all the time.
Yeah, no, I do that too.
Same,
I do that
same,
too.
Same. Same, but different, but still same. I think that we do get shades of this in episode two, but it's like the depth and the nuance to what Rhaenyra is going through is so phenomenal in Emma Darcy's performance as Rhaenyra. Like, truly, I continue to just be gobsmacked by the way that Emma Darcy makes Rhaenyra feel like such a lived-in, visceral, like, truly emotionally reacting in real time to their circumstances type of character. And I don't think that, like, we immediately see Jace's death harden her. In fact, I think Jace's death drives her to a new low. Drives her to, like, a new breaking point. And then again, this show-invented plot of there being a prophecy that has been passed down from king to king, and in this case, king to queen, seems to be more what actually makes her motivated to go get the throne. And that I also find to be a fascinating change.
And I like it, too, because it gives her more of an arc here, because I think she kind of gets, at least in how she is presented to the world at the end of this, you know, as like Daemon sort of encourages her, like, this is the moment you become queen, she kind of gets there to this, like, she was steeled. And so I could even see, like, based on what we see here, some historian being like, she was steeled by the death of her son, and that's why she went to King's Landing and all of that stuff. So it's a, it fits, actually, the context of it within, like, awareness of, like, the arc of her character within the show that we see that a historical text wouldn't have.
Yeah, totally. And, yeah. I think I'm just still very stuck on how much I loved. I mean, I've been Millie Alcock was also phenomenal as Rhaenyra. Like, I really feel like
Supergirl. Hell yeah. Even though I know that sadly the box office didn't back her up, but I loved Millie as Supergirl.
I think she's phenomenal and has a long career ahead of her, because yes. I think that Millie Alcock handing off the character of Rhaenyra to Emma Darcy was, like, incredibly seamless. I think that is at the heart of why I even make this adaptation, is to turn Rhaenyra, this famed character in the histories of House Targaryen, into a real living, breathing girl turned woman who is truly just, like, up against the worst odds you can imagine in Westeros. And we're watching her needing to constantly navigate a changing emotional landscape, both from her own family, from her allies, and then, of course, from the enemies, which leads us to Alicent, if it's now time to jump to Alicent.
Yes, let us jump over to Alicent. I will say, though, one thing I did see online, someone said we should just call them Emmy D'Arcy at this point instead of Emma D'Arcy. So just give them the Emmy.
Absolutely.
Yep. Well, moving on, Alicent is effectively a whole new character for the show in many ways. She's barely mentioned in the history during these events, and the one mention she gets directly contradicts what happened in the show. Fire and Blood claims Alicent tried to talk Aemond out of leaving King's Landing and flying to Harrenhal. The show's versions of events have Alicent practically begging him on her knees to leave, with an entire invented conspiracy happening between her and Rhaenyra, as well as also, you know, a little incest, you know, for mm-hmm. as a treat for right. all of us.
Yeah. Mid begging for him to leave, we get an invented detail of Aemond leaning in for a kiss, which was like a power move that I feel like might come back again in the show. But again, as it's not there in the book, so I don't know where we're going here with Aemond giving the Dowager Queen a little kiss goodbye.
Yeah.
Yeah. Literally the quote in the book, because Dowager Queen is her title, which like we do hear them use throughout the show, but in Fire and Blood, the only quote mentioned really about Alicent, like literally from the Red Sewing all the way like through to Rhaenyra arriving at the castle, the only line mentioned about Alicent is that she favored caution, urging her son to wait until his brother the king and his dragon Sunfire were healed so that they might join the attack at Harrenhal.
Mm. Interesting. And yeah.
Right. Like, literally the opposite of what the show's storyline is doing. And it also, like, the book also outlines how when Rhaenyra and Daemon arrive to the city to claim the throne, that Alicent is, like, one of the only people who tries to take action to stop it by, like, trying to send guards out to the gates and basically send word.
Which is also exactly the opposite.
Exactly the opposite. She literally went to the soldiers to convince them to lay down their arms. The way that it happens in the book is that the gold cloaks effectively on their own internally decide not to protest Daemon and Rhaenyra's return because they have this beloved relationship with them. Again, that the show took the time to seed in with the details from Fire and Blood about how Daemon was a commander of the Gold Cloaks during part of his time in King Viserys' reign. And so I thought that was also, you know, very interesting. Again, these changes are putting the women of the story much more in the forefront, much more in the mix of making decisions, making mistakes, experiencing consequences for those mistakes, instead of just being passive victims, basically, to all of the tragedies.
Which is interesting, too. I agree on those fronts. It is interesting, too, though, that also her sexual assault at the hands of Iron Rod was also a show invention. And if I recall, the Iron Rod was actually supposed to be a more honorable guy. I mean, which, again, history textbooks, they'll make the guy more honorable. But it is presented that way in the book. So it's just, it's interesting to me because I agree. I like how Alicent has way more agency in this story, but then they also add in this, we've talked about this in the main pod, this kind of frivolous sexual assault that, and I didn't make this connection when we were recording the main pod, but I thought of it afterwards of Sansa and all the criticisms that were leveled at the treatment of her in Game of Thrones, specifically the sort of frivolous use of sexual assault with her and Bolton. I'm blanking. Yeah, Ramsay. Bolton.
Yeah.
So I think that there's still not all lessons learned, I think, in terms of the show when it, making that. It's like not against showing sexual assault in the show. I think it's apt to show, but I think this time felt frivolous. And it's an added element from the show that the book did not have.
Yeah, because, this is what the book says. The exact quote from when the city gates fall to Rhaenyra is, quote, "The Dowager Queen Alicent emerged from Maegor's holdfast with her father, Sir Otto Hightower, Sir Tyland Lannister, and Lord Jasper Wilde, the Iron Rod." And then in parentheses, it says, "Lord Laerys Strong was not with them. The Master of Whispers had somehow contrived to disappear. Septon Eustace, a witness to what followed, tells us that Queen Alicent attempted to treat with her stepdaughter." So the picture that the book paints is, entirely different. Mm-hmm. Maegor's Holdfast, if that was what was being referenced with the quote, people might remember, it's basically like an interior castle inside the Red Keep. It's like an extra protected, defensible area. Way back in season 2 of Game of Thrones, that's where Cersei was hiding out during the Battle of the Blackwater.
Yeah, I remember that. Yeah.
Right. So like Fire and Blood kind of sets up this vision of like Alicent, her dad, who again is this has completely changed from the dynamics going on in the show, and Lord Jasper all being in there together to like try to, you know, batten down the hatches against the queen. And obviously, who knows what would have happened in that room? Like, I can see a world in which the writers are like, this could have happened, and, you know, we just don't know about it or whatever. But yeah, I'm like, I didn't need that. And I find it interesting that at this point in the book, in Fire and Blood, like, even Alicent and everyone, they don't realize Aegon's gone either. And it's funny that they mention, like, the book doesn't specify that Larys and Aegon disappeared together. Like, the fact that Lord Larys is gone is mentioned in this section. And it's like, then Rhaenyra sends her soldiers to look for Aegon and realizes like that his bedchamber is empty as well. And so, yeah, it's very fascinating. Oh, sorry, that was the other piece, is that not only does in the book Rhaenyra sends her soldiers to find Aegon, they discover that he's gone, but it's at that point that they realize that Jaehaera, who is Aegon and Helaena's only remaining daughter, is gone as well. And then there's this character of Maegor who
does not exist
in the show. But at this point, Helaena and Aegon are meant to still have two children, two heirs, Jaehaera and Maegor. And in Fire and Blood, they specify that two of the Kingsguard have vanished with these children as well. One is named Willis Fell and one is named Rickard Thorne. And so Rickard was the Kingsguard in this episode too, who was trying to keep a tail on Alicent. And then we think that he's the one who went and told Jasper Wilde, Alicent's digging around. So like, again, interesting sort of like loyalty switches happening here. And then of course the show's version of events has Alicent trying to sneak away with Helaena and Jaehaera. Again, Maegor doesn't exist. And then they get caught and brought back to the castle. Notable, I don't know if we discussed this in our main pod, but it's worth noting here, Jaehaera isn't with them when they get brought into the throne room. So like,
yeah,
currently unaccounted for. Like, whoever captured Alicent and Helaena might have her, or maybe they're creating some sort of like, we've stashed her with someone.
Somewhere.
Maybe this Willis Fell Kingsguard is like going to emerge as being with Jaehaera at some point, but interesting little shifteroos going on there.
Yeah. And then the other thing to touch upon here too is there's no beheading sequence in the book. That comes the next day, where indeed Otto and Jasper, as they are in the show, were the first two people executed. And the book only says that Rhaenyra refused to sleep until she claimed her father's seat on the night she flew to the city. So there's a quote here that you have that I'll let you read that you found that was interesting.
Yeah, it says, quote, oh, also, it's tiny detail, but like in the book, it's like nighttime and there's a storm happening when Rhaenyra and Daemon fly to the city. Like, again, such like different
vibes, just, yeah,
vibes going on, right? Whereas like them flying in the daytime, I think adds to like the like Alicent has laid the gates open for us, like we aren't sneaking our way over here, like this is the plan. So anyways, it says basically that they arrive to the castle. They don't go like straight to the throne room when they do. They find Alicent and everyone at Maegor's Holdfast. They discover Aegon is gone. And then it says, quote, so the torches were lit in the throne room. The queen climbed the iron steps and seated herself where King Viserys had sat before her. Stern-faced, still in her armor, she sat on high as every man and woman in the Red Keep was brought forth and made to kneel before her to plead for her forgiveness and swear their lives and swords and honor as their queen. Different than the order of operations we got in the show.
We get a little taste of it at one point where, like, not the same exact thing, but we see some other lords who are like locked up or like sworn fealty to her that coming and like getting some acknowledgement from her.
Yeah.
So there's a little piece of that in this.
Right. Like, but again, I think her sort of like very warmly and authentically like greeting and thanking like the people who stayed loyal to who were prisoners is like such a different vibe than like
kneel again before me and swear your allegiance.
Yeah. And so, you know, who knows? Maybe that's coming up in this next
episode.
That might
be at next episode. Yeah.
But right. Instead, they sort of switched things around so that the prisoners were at the forefront of the conversation even before she goes up to the throne. So they had it so that And that was the other difference here. It's because obviously not only is Otto not with Alicent, Alicent thinks Otto is headed back home, but he has been somehow captured and brought to the dungeons of the Red Keep in the show. And I also think that the piece of this that has changed is that the show has made it so I don't think very many people realize that Otto isn't Aegon's hand anymore, the hand of the king. And so the show set up things so that it's like Rhaenyra and Daemon think that they have to ceremoniously kill the hand of the king before she can truly ascend the throne. And obviously that's not true. In fact, her decision to execute Otto first before doing anything else is about to have what seem to be serious consequences for her ability to maintain the peace with Alicent and carry forward on this plan. So very different.
Yeah. Well, one last little miscellaneous thing, and then we'll get into our spoiler section. So be warned, that's coming up in just a minute, everybody. But one last little thing is Sir Laurent is named Queen Rhaenyra's Lord Commander of the Queen's Guard after they take the city. But instead, in the show, he's part of the Gullet Betrayal and is executed. So that's sort of an interesting little turn there as well.
Right. Yeah. She's not coming into the Red Keep with a lot of her Kingsguard around her. Sorry. Mm. Matriarchy.
Yeah. Depatriarchify your brain. We'll make it a thing. Put it on a t-shirt.
Well,
with that said, everybody, we are going to, from here on out, talk about things that might potentially be spoilers for the show, because we'll talk ahead with the book. So if you do not want any spoilers, you can jump off here. But the big thing that I just wanted to touch upon, because there's something that I found very fascinating about this episode, and there's a couple of things that you had too, was Rhaena versus Nettles. We've talked before about the sheep stealer dragon had a different rider in the books named Nettles, who was just sort of like a wild girl who had this dragon. And they've put that onto Rhaena in this show. Mm-hmm. But what I do find interesting in this episode is they kind of are even more like turning her into Nettles, because she is now sort of living on the lamb, in the Vale as sort of ward of Lady Arryn on the DL. And I kind of found that interesting, because we were talking about in the main pod how Rhaena, we were like, why didn't she go back to Rhaenyra? And obviously she has reasons for not doing so, as we discussed. But I think part of that logic, at least in the writer's room, was being like, okay, well, we can kind of even more just be like, instead of just simplifying and making Rhaena get this dragon so we have this extra dragon roaming around, now Rhaena is kind of more aligned with this sort of like wild girl Nettles that we see in the book as well. So I found that to just be an interesting sort of like way to align the characters up a little bit, which is kind of fascinating.
Yeah, they are seeming to just merge them in really interesting ways. Because yes, Nettles, and also even Sheepstealer is not meant to be a wild dragon in the Vale. He's meant to be a wild dragon on Dragonstone.
Yes.
Who's always been elusive to even like the Dragon Keepers and everybody else. And so yes, in the book, it's a young girl who's effectively like just some orphan is kind of like what they say, like doesn't even have a last name. She succeeds in claiming Sheepstealer during the Red Sowing. And then Nettles like intentionally rides Sheepstealer into battle at the Battle of the Gullet. It is interesting. We don't get much detail about what goes on, but there is a mention in Fire and Blood that Nettles like came away from the battle with like a tear-streaked face. So again, it's interesting that, yes, they seem to have like merged Rhaena leaving that battle incredibly distressed with something Nettles that happened with Nettles. But again, we don't know why Nettles was bothered at the end of that battle, aside from that it sounds like it's probably pretty scary to be a teenage girl flying a dragon into battle.
I do wonder, like, I think this is in the spoiler section, is I wonder if they'll like play it like she becomes Nettles in the history books, of like they never learn that like what happened to Rhaena, and Rhaena just kind of like, you know, Rhaenyra never sees Rhaena and is like, oh, it must be someone who's helping us, and we'll call her Nettles or whatever. So like literally like making the history textbook work, but with Rhaena in that position.
Which, yes, they might be, because I read ahead even more past like the stage that we're at in the show. And Nettles, Nettles becomes like romantically intertwined with Damon in Fire and Blood.
Oh, interesting.
right. Like the way that the histories tell it is that like he kind of adopted her as like a pseudo daughter, but again, Targaryen incest. It's like that there were, you know, that they would bathe together, that he doted upon her like more than anybody else. And that Rhaenyra even acknowledged like, let Daemon do what he wants in his bedroom and I'll do the same. That like they kind of establish like an open marriage around both Nettles and Missaria, the White Worm. But again, in the book, yeah. Missaria is Daemon's consort primarily, not Rhaenyra's, which they've kind of shifted things around.
Or they're like, it up.
Right. They're giving them like a little polycule in the Red Keep. but in Fire and Blood, Nettles becomes a point of contention between Rhaenyra and Daemon when Rhaenyra wants to basically take Nettles' head for a reason. I don't remember the exact reason off the top of my head right now. I'm sorry. That's what this whole section is for. But I was rereading it and wondering if like, oh, they've sort of set up Rhaena now to be on Rhaenyra's chopping block, basically, if and when Rhaenyra ever finds out that this is what it was. And Rhaena, again, people might not remember this, Rhaena is Daemon's daughter. So again,
which kind of lines in a creepy way, but it lines up if he is like doting on her as a daughter, like quite literally,
yes,
and hopefully without the creepy incest vibes. But again, yeah. Who knows?
Who knows? But like it becomes at this point in the show, Rhaenyra and Daemon are operating as such a big team. Like they're really seem connected. Daemon seems like unequivocally supportive of Rhaenyra. I can see a future plot point in the show being that Rhaenyra wants Rhaena to answer for her crimes or something, and Daemon is like, whoa,
that's a
step too far. That's literally my daughter. And so, yeah, that's another way that they might be blending.
Yeah, no, that's interesting. Well, two things that we wanted to also quick talk about in the spoiler section is Gwaine Hightower is actually in King's Landing for the book version of these events, serving as the second in command of the Goldcloaks. This is where Luther Largent gets introduced by killing Gwaine. So you had a quote here from this. So.
Yeah, spoiler there. That's why I put it in this section, because I'm like, other people
might kill this character.
might not want to know that Gwaine is doomed, but Gwaine seems rather doomed unless they completely change his storyline in the books. But yeah, he's part and parcel with this, you know, somewhat not bloodless, but sacking of
a little less blood by comparison to other bloody battles we get. Yeah.
I do like this section though. It says Queen Alicent's brother was seized, disarmed, and dragged before his commander, Luther Largent. When Hightower denounced him as a turncloak, Sir Luther laughed. Daemon gave us these cloaks, he said, and they're gold no matter how you turn them. Then he drove his sword through Sir Gawain's belly and ordered the city gates open. Wow. Yeah.
That's a fun quote. Yeah.
Yeah, right? I was kind of surprised we didn't get the, like, they're gold no matter how you turn them line. I kind of thought that might happen in the throne room when they were being confronted.
It still might happen though. They might still get he might still get that moment. It's too good a line not to.
Yeah.
Hopefully. Yeah. And then last thing we wanted to quick talk about was, did we skip the biggest land battle, quote unquote? There was almost a throwaway line in this episode where Simon Strong congratulates Daemon on victory and the Red Fork, the battle we saw at the tail end of in episode one, and a victory, quote, at the lake. In the books, a massive battle is described as taking place after Rhaenyra ascends the Iron Throne, led by Roddy the Ruin and the Winter Wolves. So we have a little thing there with that as well.
Yeah, that like this celebration that they were having in the woods. I have a feeling that like they might have sneakily tried to imply that like, oh, they're also celebrating this big land battle and we're just not going to show you that.
What that was.
Which, like, is fine. But yeah, this is another one that has a good quote. And also why I think that this is what they did sneakily in this episode is because of this reference to fish feed. The song that all of those soldiers were singing in the forest was about fish feed. And yeah, the quote from Fire and Blood says, in the annals of the Citadel, it is known as the Battle by the Lakeshore. But to those men who lived to tell of it, it was always the fish feed. attacked from three sides, the Westermen, aka the Lannisters, were driven back foot by foot into the waters of the God's Eye. Hundreds died there, cut down whilst fighting in the reeds. Hundreds more drowned as they tried to flee. By nightfall, 2,000 men were dead, amongst them many notables, and then dot, dot, dot. And it's like, none of our main characters in the show were involved in this battle, but it's like, this is one of those sections of Fire and Blood where you just hear that, like, a ton of lords got wiped out from all of these lesser houses at this battle. And so the song that they're singing about, like, oh, there's so many men that you can't see the water and fish feed. I was like, I think that we're just like, that all of this is just happening off screen, which is the
you gotta say budget somewhere. Yeah. I mean,
totally.
Yeah.
Like, literally almost every page of Fire and Blood has a reference to like some skirmish, some fight. So they have a ton to choose from. They have to pick their battles, literally. and yeah, I think it's interesting that I think that we have skipped the battle by the lakeshore. So yeah, just a note for any of you book readers, if you were curious about that.
Oh, we miss our fish feed.
Yeah.
But anything else that you wanted to discuss before we wrap out, Kim?
I think that's all of like the deep stuff to go in for now. I think we're going to do another one of these bonus episodes after next week.
Yeah.
And I'll just preview for folks for that one. I think then we're going to get a little more into like the missing kids, the questionable
who's
kids.
Yeah.
I think once we see where the show is putting Jahera and all of that, we're going to do a deeper dive into sort of what is going on and why George might be miffed about it, because this was one of the things that George R. R. Martin was blogging about that was frustrating him about this adaptation, was sort of a butterfly effect changing with what's going on with all of the younger generations. So,
well, we will, if that's not a good enough tease for you, I don't know what is. We got some George R. R. Martin drama coming next week, so please join us for our bonus episode next week. Otherwise, please don't forget to consider subscribing here wherever you are listening to this episode, and we thank you so much for listening. See you next week for episode 3 of House of the Dragon.